VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. A Hamas official says that after a weeks-long hiatus, international mediators have resumed negotiating with the militant group and Israel over a ceasefire in Gaza, and that he was hopeful a deal to end the 14-month war was within reach. An official in Hamas's political wing, Bassem Naim, said Thursday in an interview with the Associated Press that there have been efforts to end the fighting, release hostages from Gaza, and free Palestinian prisoners in Israel.
What I got from our brothers and colleagues in the movement, that yes, there are reactivation of the negotiation talks.
But Naim said that no quote-unquote solid, well-formed new ceasefire proposal has yet been presented to Hamas. Ceasefire negotiations were halted last month when Qatar suspended its talks with mediators from Egypt and the United States over frustration with a lack of progress between Israel and Hamas. A ceasefire was declared last week between Israel and Hamas ally Hezbollah in Lebanon. Video released on Telegram shows Syrian insurgents sweeping into the central city of Hama after days of intense clashes with government forces. The Syrian army said Thursday it has withdrawn from Hama after insurgents broke through its defenses. It is yet another setback for President Bashar al-Assad, only days after losing control of the city of Aleppo. The Syrian army said it redeployed from Hama and took positions outside the city to protect civilians. The stunning week-long offensive appears likely to continue, with the insurgents setting their sights on the central city of Homs. This is VOA News. U.S. senators on Capitol Hill will soon be weighing in on President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The traditional process in the nation's capital. President-elect Donald Trump's nominees for key cabinet positions meeting with the U.S. senators who will decide if they should be confirmed. Trump's pick to lead the U.S. State Department, Republican Senator Marco Rubio, is expected to be confirmed.
The president sets foreign policy. Our job at state will be to execute.
But Pete Hegseth, Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, has never held a leadership position in the military. He was a host on the conservative Fox News network.
We're putting the warfighters first. That's what Donald Trump asked me to do. Your job is to bring a warfighting ethos back to the Pentagon.
Hegseth is one of several nominees with a history of controversial policy remarks that some Republican senators could have a hard time confirming. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Secret Service's acting director is vowing big changes in the agency's culture and operations after the assassination attempt against Trump in the state of Pennsylvania. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Ronald Rowe says it was an abject failure and he's taking action.
We are reorganizing and reimagining this organization.
But as he appeared before a bipartisan House task force, panel members pushed Rowe on how so many things went wrong, like a drone operator unable to get his drone to work and a counter sniper positioned behind a tree.
Yet nobody said anything.
Democrat Jason Crow and a fellow veteran, Republican Mark Green.
Apathy and complacency, period.
Rowe says when he was a protective agent, everyone felt empowered to speak up when something wasn't right.
I don't know where we lost that.
The panel's public report on the shooting will be out next week. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Law enforcement officials say there was writing on the bullets used to kill an American healthcare executive. AP correspondent Jake Offenhartz reports from New York.
The masked gunman who fatally shot the chief executive of United Healthcare on a Manhattan sidewalk Wednesday used ammunition emblazoned with the words deny, defend, and depose. That's according to law enforcement officials, who also told the AP that the shooter used a silencer on his gun. A motive in the killing has not yet been identified, but the words may refer to a strategy used by insurance companies to deny coverage to patients.
AP correspondent Jake Offenhartz. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, December 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghanaians vote tomorrow, Saturday, in presidential and parliamentary elections.
If I had a word to describe the mood, would be that of jubilation, that of celebration. Every single person that I talk to is excited about what this election means to them.
The new UN humanitarian aid chief appeals for more funding. Big polluters and islands this clash in the top UN court on climate change. Indigenous Kenya men campaign against female genital mutilation. Africa's women-led startups struggle to find investors.
It's easy and not easy at the same time. Because you're a woman, people easily approach you because, oh, you know what you are doing. But when it comes to seeking investments, it could be difficult.
And the U.S. Senate considers President-elect Trump's cabinet elections. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghanaians go to the poll tomorrow, Saturday, to elect a new president and members of parliament. President Nana Akufo-Addo is not seeking re-election due to term limitation, but his vice president, Mahamudu Bawumia, is the candidate for the ruling New Patriotic Party, NPP. His main challenger is former President John Dramani Mahama of the National Democratic Congress, NDC Party. The candidates had their final campaign rallies on Thursday. VOA's Paul Ndiho is in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, covering the election.
If I had a word to describe the mood, would be that of jubilation, that of celebration. Every single person that I talk to is excited about what this election means to them, is excited about Vice President becoming the President of the Republic of Ghana. When you talk to opposition people, they also excited about the possibility that former President John Dramani Mahama might become the President of Ghana. So either way, each side is looking forward to having their candidate win this presidential election.
So what are the issues that are on the minds of Ghanaians as they vote on Saturday?
So many issues. As I was attending some of these rallies, I ran into people who are talking about, for example, the ruling party, how they have done an incredible job when it comes to education, free education for all, from primary to secondary. You talk to parents, parents are excited for the first time their children are going to school for free. You talk to people who have experienced that, who had to pay tuition or sell property, sell whatever it is that they had to do to take their kids to school. They look at this as a perfect opportunity for them. I also talk to people who say, for example, if they had a similar opportunity of going to school for free, it would have made a difference in their lives. So from the voters I talk to, that's one thing that they all agree on. Then, of course, there is the economy. When you talk to people in the opposition, on the other hand, they talk about how the economy is bad. They talk about how the cost of living is very high. The prices are very high. Unemployment is very high. But simply put, I think Ghana, they have done it before, and I think they are on a trajectory to do it again, because when you move around, you talk to people, I think everything is going to work out as expected. It might be very close, but it's going to be a smooth election.
The young people, how involved are they in the political process there? Are they looking forward to voting?
I think the young people could be the ones that are really swing this election into a different direction. Take, for example, the people who have benefited from free primary school, free secondary school, guess what? They are eligible to vote in this election. So that's a huge, huge demographic. You talk about jobs. The current government has been talking about creating jobs, creating digital jobs, where they embrace technology, where they're encouraging building schools, building ecosystems where young people can thrive, who have ideas, can bring these ideas, put them in the marketplace and start small businesses. So the current government has done that, and the vice president who is running on the ticket of the ruling party wants to push that. So a lot of young people are excited about the possibility of them being part of this digital economy.
That view is Paul Ndiho speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra, where he's covering Saturday's presidential election. The world is on fire. That's what new UN Humanitarian Aid Chief Tom Fletcher told reporters in Geneva this week as the agency appealed for more than $47 billion to deliver vital aid next year amid surging global conflicts. Camilla Waldzeng of the Norwegian Refugee Council tells viewers Carol Van Dam that the extreme underfunding aid groups are experiencing this year is a sign of what's to come.
What we have seen, of course, if this year is any indication, we are only now at under 44% funding compared to what is needed. And we know that several donors are planning cuts or expecting cuts, so it doesn't bode well for next year if that trend continues unless urgent action is taken.
What are the hot spots in the world that the NRC is mostly concerned about? The
situation we have now is there are so many, so we have a record number of conflicts. And there are new conflicts, of course, or relatively new conflicts like Ukraine, Gaza, now Lebanon, Sudan, which has exploded as well. But then we added that to conflicts that have been going on for a long time and that have not gone away, Somalia, Colombia, and the Sahel, and so on. So it's just that the list is really endless. And then on top of that, you see such widespread violations of international law. There's a protection crisis in many of these conflicts, so that really adds to the needs that we're seeing on the ground.
What about the protection crisis? When you talk about that, like I talked to a group, PEMA, that is interested in seeing some kind of protection force, some kind of physical impartial presence in Sudan.
We see it across many, many crises, and it's not new. It has been going on for a while. The widespread disrespect for humanitarian law, for protection of civilians generally, that is something, it's a trend that we see across the board, I would say, from many parties or from all parties in many cases to conflict. And it's not really being addressed. We're not seeing, you know, diplomatic action to try to prevent this. Not seeing the states that are in a position to influence as parties to conflict really taking robust action. And for instance, you know, they can hold back weapons. There are measures they can take, diplomatic engagement. We really need much more coordinated diplomatic engagement and pressure.
When you are dealing with refugees and people coming out of Sudan in those huge numbers, what kind of things are you doing and why does that cost so much money?
Well, yeah, it is apparently the largest displacement crisis in the world with 14 million people displaced. And, of course, the situation for civilians is horrifying. Why is it so expensive? First of all, the scale of the needs are there, and many of the areas that we work in, not only in Sudan, but in many other parts of the world, are very difficult to access. There are also a lot of impediments to access in many areas, and these are not easy areas to work in. So it's hard, it's expensive, it requires a lot of funding, and then, of course, what we've seen in recent years, which has contributed to the current funding crisis, I would say, is a rapid increase in cost, massive inflation in many places. And this has, of course, also added to the funding gap that we're seeing now. I mean, it's true that humanitarian funding actually increased rapidly for a long time, not least in response to COVID-19 pandemic and the Ukraine crisis. But then the last, in 2023, it went down. We're expecting it to continue to go down this year. But another reason is, of course, because we're rapidly raising costs that have affected everyone, but including the humanitarian community.
Camilla Waldzeng is Executive Director of Policy for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Barcelona, Spain. Businesses started by women have received less than 5% of venture capital funding in Africa over the past decade, according to a new report. The report says investment in female-started businesses decreased further last year, frustrating businesswomen and those who want investors to give them greater consideration. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Female-founded businesses are the driving force behind innovation and inclusive growth in Africa, according to a report by business research platform Brita Bridges and non-profit organization V54 Open Impact. However, female business owners face many challenges when seeking investment to help grow their businesses. Akosua Lefty is a Ghanaian businesswoman who specializes in developing products for natural hair. She says over her 2 years in business, she has struggled to attract interest from potential investors.
Word of mouth, I send my product, I discuss it with them. Sometimes they go like, oh, we'll see, I'll reach out to you about it or something, but it never comes. And sometimes friends, you talk to a couple of friends, they go like, okay, what will my percentage be and all of that? But this is something like you are starting out, so it will be difficult to actually tell. And there will be pressure if it doesn't pick off immediately, because people want to make back their money immediately they give it to you.
Brita Bridges and V54 Open Impact say that of all the capital venture funding across Africa in the past 10 years, less than 5% went to women founders. Elizabeth Mwangi is the founder of Gwiji, which connects women cleaners to clients. Mwangi got her first funding in 2020, which has helped her develop an app that could help support and empower women to make a living.
The next funding I got was in 2023, and that time I was almost giving up on Gwiji, and it's an award that I won, a global award that focuses on women called Aurora Tech Award. From there, I was able to get a funding of $30,000, and that one actually enabled us to advance. That time we didn't have an office, so we were able to have an office, a safe space for these women. We were able to launch a secondary program that helped to ensure we have holistic empowerment of our women.
Mwangi says she is partnering with more organizations like the UK government-backed Transform to widen her reach beyond Nairobi.
The aim for this is to help us empower more women for informal settlement even beyond Nairobi, because Gwiji currently is in Nairobi, but you find that every day we get calls from women from different areas in Kenya who want to join Gwiji and be able to.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, December 6th. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Men in Kenya's indigenous communities are campaigning against female genital mutilation. Through their action, dubbed Men and GM, they are sensitizing communities where cultural norms and traditions like FGM run deep. Victoria Amuga reports from Nairobi.
Naomi Kolian recounts the ordeal at her parents' house at the age of 13. Kolian, now a mother of five, says her parents arranged for her genital mutilation during a school break. She had just taken her national examination. She says, they stripped off my clothes, poured water on me. I passed out. When I recovered, I realized a certain woman was already cutting me. Out of pain, I tried to jump, so they tied both of my legs with ropes. As of 2021, at least 14.8% of Kenyan women, like Kolian, had undergone female genital mutilation or FGM, according to the Britain-based FGMC Research Initiative. 45.6% of them are cut between 5 and 9 years of age. It is seen as a rite of passage for girls that is a compulsory step before marriage. Now men are stepping up to end the practice. Through a movement dubbed Men End FGM, they are educating others on the dangers of FGM. The movement's executive director, Tony Mwebia, says most men in the communities that support FGM are ignorant of what the cut entails and are always providing resources and guiding the FGM ceremonies.
As Men and FGM, what we do is we go and have conversations with the men. We show them the visual materials. We use a lot of charts. We use videos. We use photos of complications in labor wards.
At least 600 men like Noah Sampeke, a senior chief in Kenya's Kajiado County, have joined the movement that started as an online campaign. Sampeke says he regrets keeping the tradition of marrying only women that have undergone the cut. He says that he comes from a community where it was compulsory for women to get the cut, and if she got pregnant without the cut, she was considered an outcast. But now, I will not force my girls to get the cut. In November, Kenya women rights activists began 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, among which female genital mutilation is the most egregious violation, according to advocates. They say a collective movement for change is crucial. Ajra Mohammed is country representative for Nguvu Collective, a women's advocacy group.
They might think because we have very strict regulations, people will avoid FGM, while on the ground, people are actually hiding it, and the community leaders are supporting that. So if you connect them with the grassroots activists, they'll be able now to inform them, like to be their allies and to be their whistleblowers.
Kenya ratified the Prohibition of Female Genital Mutilation Act in 2011 and established an anti-FGM board, an agency that spearheads campaigns to eradicate FGM. The agency's CEO, Bernadette Loloju, told VOA that the board is promoting alternative rites of passage like training girls into adulthood without a cut. FGM slightly declined from 21% to 15% in 2022 demographic health survey. Officials believe that the approach of incorporating men will help eradicate FGM. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. senators on Capitol Hill will soon be weighing in on President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks, with many of their choices facing questions about their beliefs and qualifications. The confirmation process could look different this time. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The traditional process in the nation's capital. President-elect Donald Trump's nominees for key cabinet positions meeting with the U.S. senators who will decide if they should be confirmed. Chuck Grassley is a Republican senator.
Your 8 years and previous experience to being Attorney General of Florida for 8 years prepares you, I'm sure, well for this job.
Trump's pick to lead the U.S. State Department, Republican Senator Marco Rubio, is expected to be confirmed.
The president sets foreign policy. Our job at state will be to execute.
But Pete Hegseth, Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, has never held a leadership position in the military. He was a host on the conservative Fox News network.
We're putting the warfighters first. That's what Donald Trump asked me to do. Your job is to bring a warfighting ethos back to the Pentagon.
Hegseth is one of several nominees with a history of controversial policy remarks that some Republican senators could have a hard time confirming. Shannon O'Brien is an associate professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin.
Incoming President Trump needs to not just assume they're going to fall in line, because you might have some that, on the even on the Republican side, if they are not given their due diligence or their due deference, they can make his life really tough.
The incoming Senate Majority Leader, Republican John Thune, pledged to swiftly hold votes on Trump's nominees.
We will do everything we can to process his noms quickly, get them installed in their positions so they can begin to implement his agenda.
But Trump has proposed installing appointees while the Senate is in recess, a sometimes controversial maneuver to bypass lawmakers' constitutional role of approving nominees.
What if the president tried to intentionally adjourn Congress using that power in order to make recess appointments? That's never happened, but when he says that he wants to make them, the only way he could possibly force that would be to force the adjournment of Congress, but that's going to wind up in the courts.
Republican senators are already pushing back. John Cornyn is a Republican senator.
Well, that's another whole issue. Obviously, I don't think we should be circumventing the Senate's responsibilities.
U.S. presidents of both parties have made recess appointments, but the Supreme Court limited that ability during the term of President Barack Obama. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
A landmark climate change case opened at the United Nations International Court of Justice in The Hague this week, aimed at clarifying the legal obligations of states to prevent climate change and to pay for any damage it causes. Several small island nations argue their very survival is at stake, as Henry Richwell reports.
It has been described as the biggest court case in the world. Judges at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, the United Nations' top legal body, have been asked to rule on whether major polluting nations can be held to account for causing climate change and its harmful effects. Smaller island nation states say rising sea levels place their very existence at stake. Arnold Keel Lockman, the Attorney General of Vanuatu, a small island state in the South Pacific, gave evidence to the court on Monday.
Under international law, states have obligations. Obligation to act with due diligence, to prevent significant harm to the environment, to reduce the emissions and provide support to countries like mine, to protect the human rights of present and future generations.
The judges will consider not only legally binding climate agreements, but also international human rights law. The court is hearing testimony from countries responsible for much of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, including the United States. Margaret Taylor is a State Department legal advisor who is representing the United States at the International Court of Justice.
International human rights law, however, does not obligate states to mitigate anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, nor does it currently provide for a human right to a healthy environment.
Many big polluters argue that the only relevant laws are derived from existing climate agreements and that other legislation isn't relevant. The judge's opinion won't be legally binding, but it will carry weight. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Nigeria, a very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with these weekend's fixtures in the Confederation of African Football Champions League as Group A leaders Al Hilal Omdurman aim to build on their promising start as they face TP Mazembe in the CAF Champions League on Sunday. In Group B, Maimena Union hosts Raja Casablanca while FAR Rabat welcomes South African champions Mamelodi Sundowns to start Ben Ahmed El Abdi. Group C of the CAF Champions League promises to be electric as Orlando Pirates face Al Ahly and start the Abidjan will host CR Belouizdad. With all four teams chasing points, the group is set for a decisive shake-up. Elsewhere in Group D, Esperance de Tunis will visit Sagrada Esperanca in Angola on Friday, while Pyramid FC head to Mali to face Djoliba on Sunday. Both matches promises to shape the trajectory of the group stage. Staying with football news, the government of Uganda has allocated around $95 million to ensure the smooth organization of the African Nations Championship CHAN, which will take place from February the 1st to 28th, 2024. These funds will be used to expedite infrastructure development, improve facilities, and pay the commitment fees to the Confederation of African Football. Uganda Minister of State for Sports, Peter Ogwang, said the CHAN Championship slated for February next year will emphasize accountability across all sections.
We will need everybody to be accountable to whatever actions he or she does, be it financial or not financial, so that we remain with one point of making sure that the public, the taxpayers, appreciate what we would have done during our time and era when we hosted both CHAN and AFCON.
In basketball news, Nairobi City Thunder has qualified for the Basketball Africa League BAL on their first attempt, playing in front of a lively crowd at the 5,000-seater Kasarani Indoor Arena. Nairobi City Thunder edged out Uganda City Oilers 72-62 to secure their place in the 2025 Basketball Africa League. This victory not only booked their spot but also made Thunder the first Kenyan team to qualify for the league, achieving the milestone on their debut in the road to the Basketball Africa League. Bradley Ibis is Nairobi City Thunder coach.
I think it's been a really amazing experience to have this event hosted in Kenya, for us to be the first Kenyan club to qualify for ball, to be able to go 5-0 in front of our amazing fans that kept showing up game after game, and just a really beautiful experience for our club and I think for Kenyan basketball at large.
And finally, in badminton news, Africa's first Paralympic medalist in badminton, Eniola Bolaji, has expressed her determination to achieve greater success at the Los Angeles 2028 Games as the Badminton Confederation of Africa launched the groundbreaking Road to LA 2028 program in Abuja. And that does it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, December 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.